Psalm 82. This psalm may be, some scholars suggest it could be, an Israelite adaptation of a pre-Israelite hymn. Now, we'll see why they suggest that as a possibility, but I just bring it in here as another little thing to add to your consciousness. We're dealing with hymns here, and music and poetry, and the source could come from anywhere, and there's nothing against, is there? We do it today. We adapt music from the secular world to a hymn, and perhaps change some of the words, and so they would do it. This may be a very, very ancient piece of poetry. It begins with the verses, and I'll stay with these for quite a while, the first verse. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. So the image, this is the whole psalm, and get this clear or it won't work. The high god, El, which is the Semitic god, Zeus, the Greek, you know, but El, E-L, is surrounded by all the lesser gods, and they're holding court in Olympus, it would be if it was the Greeks, but up in the mountain, the high place. And I'll give you some other, for example, try these. 1 Kings chapter 22, 19. I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne with all the host of heaven standing beside him to the right and to the left. Now, later on we'll imagine the host of heaven being angels, but more primitively they were gods, lesser gods. And the image, of course, comes from the court. Here we have in the first book of Samuel, chapter 22, Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand and his servants standing around him. So all our images of God come from ordinary life. So don't be a martyr over a word or you're wasting your time. Words are words. They're all human. All the words of the Bible are human too. All the words of the canon law are human. All the dogmas of the church are human words. They're human words. Okay. Now the purpose of human words is really important to get them right, because wrong words can face us away from the mystery. The right words can face us towards the mystery, but the right words cannot contain the mystery. They can only open us up to it. So you don't... You try to get your words as right as they can be, but we're never allowed to think that the truth is in the words. The words face us towards the truth. And if words are wrong, we've got to correct each other. And that's what heresy is about. And church magisterium is about saying, no, that's wrong. That's not what we believe by the Eucharist. That's not what we believe by the Trinity. That's not what we believe by the Incarnation, you know? Because Trinity, you could end up with three gods if you're not careful. And in the minds of most people, I think, without thinking, they have got three gods. And that's no wonder the Muslims think we're dreadful. That's often the way we speak. Why wouldn't they think we think we've got three gods? First person of the Trinity, second person of the Trinity, and the third person of the Trinity. What's a person mean today? One person, two person, three persons. Well, if you've got three persons of the Trinity, you've got three gods. If you go back to Augustine of Hippo, where he's the one who talks about the three persons. That's not the Greek word. The Greek is hypostasis, which is a metaphysical term, nothing to do with it. Now, a person in Augustine's time, listen to it if you know any Latin, persona. Sona is sound, you know that, per is through. The persona was the mask worn by an actor in the big theatre so that you'd know who the actor was portraying. Clytemnestra or Hecuba or Aeneas or Odysseus, because they wore the Odysseus mask. Well, whoever's wearing that, that's Odysseus. Do you get it? And the sound came through the persona. So let's be careful about three persons in one God. We're saying, I think primarily, God, how'd I get onto this? Anyhow, I'm here now. Can you bear with me while I continue it? We're saying we're primarily humble people using human words, saying if you want to listen to God speaking to you, then God is, of course, transcendent. You won't hear God, but you can hear Jesus. And he is the human persona through whom God speaks to us. Ah, he who hears me hears the Father. He who sees me sees the Father. He's the incarnation in the human expression, in other words, icon, symbol, all these words, of God. And you can listen in your heart to the Spirit of God who was poured into our hearts and into the heart of the community and spoken through the prophets. Are you with me? That's where you hear the sound, listen to the voice, connect with the mystery of God. So that's primarily what we're saying in the Trinity. It doesn't stop Jesus being human, and it doesn't stick something else into his head, and it doesn't stop the Spirit being the breath of God moving through human hearts and community. It's very human stuff, isn't it? And then we also have to say something more, which is, we don't know what we're saying, but we all words about mystery like that. We say God must be such as to be able to be accessed through Jesus and through the Spirit. So God must be not just an isolated, transcendent monad, if you want to use the philosophical term, but God must be communion. God must be communion, much more like a family, mum, dad and first baby. God must be something like communion in love, to be able to be accessed and to reach us through the human Jesus and the mysterious Spirit. Now I'm giving you a talk on the Trinity, which is not the purpose of this, but it's all... I guess I started by saying, words are words. Don't teach the Trinity to kids by using a triangle, or even, God bless him, Patrick with the clover leaf, and that's all. They're little images. They're all right images. And I suggest don't use the words first person, second person, and third person. Because first, second, and third are mathematical terms and quantitative terms. They muck it all up. They take it into geometry. Talk about the one whom Jesus called Abba, God, Father, Mother, and the source of everything. Talk about Jesus, Mary's child, who was crucified and died, and talk about the Spirit that we experience in our hearts. Isn't that... what do you want to talk about anything else for? Then you're talking about the Trinity, and you're not getting into some mathematical conundrum which won't help you and will put everybody else off who are monotheists. Okay, back to our psalm. The psalm, as we'll see, just introducing it, the psalmist identifies Yahweh as the sovereign God summoning the lesser gods. We'll see that. Micah, I'll read to you first 4:5. All the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but we walk in the name of Yahweh, our God, forever and ever. Psalm 95. Yahweh is a great God, a great king above all gods. Presuming there are plenty of other gods. Psalm 97. All gods bow down before him, for you, Yahweh, are most high over all the earth, and exalted far above all gods, the gods of the Moabites and the Ammonites and all the rest. Exodus 15:11. Yahweh, who is like you among the gods? Now, at the time of the exile, which is 6th century BC, contact with other peoples led to the first glimmers of what will become monotheism. Theoretical monotheism, anyhow. Here, Isaiah 41:29. The gods are a delusion. See, they went to Babylon, the greatest kingdom in that Middle East area, Iraq. Okay, they went to Babylon, southern Iraq. And they were astonished to find that this great kingdom, which was well ahead in language and mathematics and the beginnings of science and astrology and so on, and rich in trade and nothing like their little back of the woods place in the hill country of Judah, but they found that their gods, this is what they saw, their gods were bits of wood carved by human beings in a temple. They thought, heavens, is that the best they can do? And they didn't even have any mountains. They had to make their own mountains because it's flat country, it's alluvial plain. So they built these ziggurats, the Tower of Babel is a story about these, They had the moon goddess was the one they were worshipping. Now, the Jews didn't understand them because the people of Babylon weren't worshipping bits of wood, for heaven's sake. They were worshipping what it represented for them. But we tend to misunderstand other people's religions unless we belong to them. So they didn't understand it. But they did get a shock and realized how wonderful their God was, whom you could never make an image of. Because the God they worshipped, Yahweh, was the creator of everything. Not just bits of wood or bits of... Okay, so their gods are a delusion, their works are nothing, their images are empty wind, says Isaiah 41. The letter of Jeremiah, Baruch chapter 6 it is. In Babylon you'll see gods made of silver and gold and wood, which cause the heathen to fear. Beware of letting fear for these gods possess you. Say in your heart, it is you, O Lord, whom we must worship. In monotheistic Judaism, gods, so when Judaism became theoretically monotheistic, gods, that expression, and the expression sons of gods were interpreted as referring to angelic beings. So they then came down a peg and became angels. Oh, sons of gods, Psalm 21, ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. Oh, heavenly beings. And some translation will say, oh, angels. Job 1:6, one day the sons of the gods, that's the literal expression, heavenly beings, came to present themselves before Yahweh, and one of them was Satan in the book of Job. And Satan is not a bad person in the book of Job. This is the oldest choice. Satan was quite a good, Satan just had a crook job. He was the counsel for the prosecution. Well, the counsel for the prosecution, maybe your husband or your wife is the counsel for the prosecution. They're quite nice people at home. But they've got a definite job to do, and that is to test whether this person really is innocent or guilty. So Satan spends his time all through the book of Job testing whether Job really is so nice. And when things happen to Job, he ends up, he's not as nice as people thought he was. God, at the beginning, is pretty proud of Job, but towards the end, he's not that happy with him, because he's like all of us. He gets a bit overpowered with... Anyhow, in the Psalms, gods were sometimes interpreted as referring to human administrators of justice acting with God-given authority. And we still haven't started the Psalm, but the last bit of introduction is to prepare you for it by reading Wisdom chapter 6, the first 8 verses. And I'll just read it as it is. You just enjoy it or whatever. Listen, O kings, and understand. Learn, O judges of the ends of the earth. Give ear, you that rule over multitudes and boast of many nations. For your dominion was given you from the Lord. This is written in Greek. So, Kurios, which of course is Yahweh in Hebrew. But this is written in Greek, so it's no Hebrew behind it. You from the Lord, and your sovereignty from the Most High. He will search out your works and inquire into your plans, because as servants of his kingdom you did not rule rightly, or keep the law, or work, or walk according to the purpose of God. God will come upon you terribly and swiftly, because severe judgment falls on those in high places. For the lowliest may be pardoned in mercy, but the mighty will be mightily tested. For the Lord of all will not stand in awe of anyone or show deference to greatness, because he himself made both small and great, and he takes thought for all alike, but a strict inquiry is in store for the mighty. Those responsible for the administration of justice have a major responsibility, anyone with leadership, of course. And so these people have to act in God's name. Let's go to the psalm. And with all that introduction, the psalm is reasonably straightforward. Verse 1. And picture it. It's an ancient mythical thing, probably from pre-Israelite times. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he, that's God, holds judgment. So he stands up, or perhaps sits, I don't know which. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the orphan. This is the God of Israel. It's beautiful. The God of justice for the poor. Give justice to the weak and the orphan. You know, stop favoring the mighty and the powerful, the people who got money and the big business as against some poor little employer and all this stuff. Maintain the right of the lowly and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. That's great, isn't it? That's the image of Israel's God. No wonder Jesus picked it up and ran with it. I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and all that. A couple of other references that say the same thing. Psalm 10 verse 18. Do justice for the orphan and the oppressed. Zephaniah chapter 3. I will leave in the midst of you a people humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of Yahweh. The Torah throughout, I'm reading now from the books of the Torah, insist on the proper administration of justice. And that's the purpose of this psalm. Leviticus 19, you shall not render an unjust judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. With justice you shall judge your neighbor. Deuteronomy chapter 1. I charged your judges at that time, quote, give the members of your community a fair hearing and judge rightly between one person and another, whether citizen or resident alien, residing in the luxury of our various detention centers. You must not be partial in hearing. Hear out the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. These are powerful stuff, and just as relevant today as ever. Deuteronomy 16, you must not distort justice. Who was it? Voltaire said, justice is like a cobweb. The small flies get caught, the large flies break free. Is he wrong? You must not distort justice. You must not show partiality. You must not accept bribes. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. Back to our psalm, verse 5. They have neither knowledge nor understanding, says the psalmist. They grope in the dark. First letter of John, in fact, the last words of the first letter of John. We know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know him. Know, always in the Bible, intimate communion. Him who is true. And we are in him who is true, in his Son, Jesus Christ. He is the true God and eternal life. And what an interesting end to this wonderful letter of John all about love. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. False gods. If we don't open our heart to the, and that's a very modern, a massively modern problem, isn't it? It seems to me, the growing atheism of our world and agnosticism. If we don't acknowledge the true God, we will create our own, for sure. It'll be myself, it'll be the bottom line, it'll be economic. Last night I listened to the news for about 2 minutes and they were always talking, but they were talking about the economy as though it's a person. The economy, and it's, we're about social. The people are what matters. Economies to serve the people. But we're all worshipping this damn thing called the economy. And you don't, I didn't believe anything I was hearing, do you? Hopefully it'll be better tonight. And the more of us don't believe it, the better. But we're going to have a whole community completely shut off from the political world and perhaps the ecclesiastical world if we're not careful. You know, we're all this talk, but we don't believe it. So we're going to be all going back into barbarism. Oh God, I'm overstating that, but I really think it's dreadful. Keep yourself from idols. And if people say, oh, I don't believe in God, I'd like to know what they do believe in, and that's what I'd call God. And it'll be something far less than the mystery of love that Jesus reveals. It'll be something far more frightening, useless, empty. 1 John 2 says, all that is in the world, says John, the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eyes, pride in riches, comes not from the Father, but from the world. So these people are not open to justice and listening to the poor and open to love. Well, they grope in the dark, says our psalmist. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They may be brilliant in little narrow areas where human beings can be brilliant, but they're completely unwise and they're in the dark. Our psalm continues, all the foundations of the earth are shaken. When justice doesn't happen, everything gets shaky. Fear comes in. Terrorism has become the great excuse, hasn't it, for the taking away of human rights at very massive levels all over the world, and for right-wing governments to come into place in the name of anti-terrorism and take control, which means control of money, control of the economy, control of people, pride, luxury, injustice, dreadful stuff. Verse 6, I say, this is God speaking to the lesser gods, although you are gods, and the definition of a god is immortal. That's what God means. That's in the whole ancient world. If you're immortal, you're a god. If you're mortal, you're not a god. Okay. I say, although you are gods, children of the Most High, all of you, nevertheless, you shall die like mortal human beings and fall like any prince. Heavens, the high God is threatening all these other immortals with mortality. So you couldn't get a bigger threat. They might think that their immortal status as gods will save them, but it won't save them, says Zeus, or whoever it was in the ancient El, and now Yahweh. God said, Genesis 3:3, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die. Now, when I was a child, probably when you were a child, and we read, we're all right as a children, we read the book of Genesis, you know, as though it was real, true, which probably means factual to a child, I don't know, you know, the whole mix-up. And so we were taught, I remember distinctly being taught, that Adam and Eve, before the fall, were immortal. What a load of garbage. It's not in the Bible that it says that at all. It's a total misunderstanding of it. Of course human beings are mortal, by definition. So, and we didn't die because we sinned, otherwise we'd have been all, God, we'd been all cluttering up the earth. We'd have had beards all over the place, and just picture the scene. There'd be no cemeteries, all right, so we'd have all that land. But where would we all fit? And we'd have great, going back to Adam, all alive, all immortal. I mean, you know, just, we've got to let our brain kick in after a while. Now, God is simply saying, he's threatening them, like mum and dad might have threatened me. If you do this, something's going to happen to you. Now, what God is saying is, if you sin, you'll die. It's poisonous, this tree. You'll die from it. It's a dreadful, don't eat that berry that you've got in the backyard because it's poisonous. So, you know, that's warning me not to eat it. And that's good. Warning. Well, God's saying, don't eat, because this tree of knowledge of good and evil, this tree of being the center of your own universe and deciding what you think is good and what I think is good and what I think is bad, it'll kill you, it'll destroy you, it'll kill your soul, you'll die. And then when it happens, of course, they don't die. God is a great, he's like grandma, can't hit the kids. Could hit your own kids, but your grandkids, you just can't go near them. They're darling little things, they never do anything wrong. So what does God say at the end? He says, oh, I don't know about you lot. He says, well, look, you know, you can't be in paradise if you're going to behave like this because, you know, you've mucked that up. And then they make these little fig leaves. And there's one of the lovely little scenes in, God looks at them with the fig leaves on them and says, oh, shit. So then God makes little things for them out of skins to clothe them. God's up in heaven, you know, needlework. Well, it's all lovely. It's all story. It's all, and it's saying some beautiful truths if we dare to let it flow over us as a story. But when we take it, for example, in the Bible, there's no fall, by the way. Though if you read the modern catechism, you'd still think there was. You know, it's very slow for the teaching church to catch up with ordinary scholarship. There was no fall. There was no before. I mean, I don't know. If you're an American, you're probably not even allowed to teach about evolution, but I mean, the most likely theory is that there's evolution in the world. Anyhow, it's only a theory, if you like. I don't care what you think about it, but it seems to me if that's most likely. But and there's no reason against evolution, and nothing from the Bible is against it. But if you think that, just look at it. I mean, whatever we did, I don't think that we were kind of immortal and then became mortal and we had all these things and we would have been in paradise. No, human beings are, this is what we're at. The story of the book of Genesis is what we should be if we had have listened to God. It's a story of the ideal. God's will for humanity is that we live in love and in a paradise. And the book of Apocalypse ends up with the same image of paradise. This world should be a paradise, and it would be a paradise if we all listened to God and loved. That's what the book of Genesis is about. It's not saying it once was, or and now isn't, as though we fell from there down to here. This is where we are. Why? Because we sin. Let's stop sinning, and that's what we should be. Conclude our psalm. Verse 6. I say, although you are gods, children of the Most High, you shall die like mortal human beings and fall like any prince. This is actually quoted by Jesus in John's Gospel, chapter 10, verse 34, when they accused Jesus of making himself equal with God. Jesus would never do that. Make himself equal with God? And he says, come on. And he says, you read John carefully, and John is the most sublime, divine gospel. But the Jesus of John's gospel never says, I'm equal with God. Never would say it. He says, everything I hear from the Father. Everything I do because it's my Father's will. Everything I am about is about revealing the beautiful God that I pray to and know. And he wasn't praying to himself. You're following my... make Jesus what he really is, human. Well, this is what Jesus says when they accuse him of making himself equal with God. First of all, he's not making himself anything, and he's certainly not making himself equal with God. Look what he says. Is it not written in the Torah, I say you are gods? Here it is here. Psalm 82, verse 6. If those to whom the word of God came, these are the administrators of justice in the land who are not acting very justly, are you with me? If those to whom the word of God came were called, inverted commas, gods, and scripture cannot be annulled, in other words, it's God, they're acting in God's name. So they're delegates of God in this justice area. Well, can you say that the one whom the Father has sanctified, Jesus is holy only because of God's grace, not because of anything he did. It's God has sanctified Jesus and sent into the world, and that doesn't mean he was up in heaven and then came down to earth. Jesus didn't exist before Jesus. He didn't come anywhere. He was conceived. How many years? I'm 68. Well, 69 years ago, I wasn't somewhere waiting to come. Neither were you. He was sent into the world as a mission, the way you've been sent. I'm sent. We're often sent. The Father has sanctified... is blaspheming because I said... Now, what did I say, says Jesus? Did I say I was equal to God? I said, I am God's son. My life comes from God. My words come from God. My authority comes from God. God is my Father, my Abba, my source of life. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying I'm equal with God. And he quotes this psalm in that argument with the Pharisees, because that's the only kind of thing that they all agree on, the importance of the Bible. The psalm ends, verse 8, rise up, O God. So that's the end of the word. Rise up, O God, judge the earth, please, because your justice, your judgment will be beautiful, for you are sovereign over all the nations.